Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may be listed in the court.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the William G. Myers Trust, or the appellees in this case, versus the Ikes, who are the appellants in this case. The party's positions being reversed below. For the appellants on appeal is Mr. Thomas Wolka, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee, Mr. Roger Hunt, an attorney from Brandon. Mr. Wolka, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Hunt. Your Honor, I am Tom Wilkin. I represent Mike and Sherry Ike in this case. They were the defendants down below, and they are the appellants here. The fundamental issue that we are urging upon the court is that there exists, in this case, an equitable mortgage based upon the transactions which commenced in September of 1999 when Mr. Myers, in return for loaning the Ikes $125,000 plus charging them a $10,000 finder's fee, the loan being at 14% interest, had them sign a series of documents. Included within these documents is a letter which is in the record as Exhibit A, which is entitled Instructions to Borrowers, and it specifically states in a couple of different places that the documents are intended as security for the money being loaned to the Ikes. Now, the hurdle which we must overcome in this case is that at that time in 1999 and also later in 2003, Mr. and Mrs. Ike signed warranty deeds, which purported to convey the property to the trust or Mr. Myers. These deeds were prepared by Myers, who is an experienced real estate agent, a much more sophisticated individual than the Ikes. In fact, Myers' level of sophistication is illustrated by the fact that he was not only a licensed real estate agent, but he has an advanced degree in electrical engineering, had worked as an electrical engineer, and had also worked as a commercial pilot. Mr. Ike is a truck repairman who runs his truck repair shop. The record shows that the Ikes were not at all well-versed in business practices. In fact, the payments that they made on these loans to Mr. Myers over the years, they kept no records of them. So that when the case had to be litigated, they were totally at the mercy of the records kept by Mr. Myers, and some of those records called amortization schedules are in the record as exhibits, particularly 9 and 10. And what the Ikes would do, once again, is an illustration of their lack of sophistication, particularly compared to that of Mr. Myers. Sometimes they would take checks that they had received from customers whose trucks they had repaired, and they simply endorsed them over to Mr. Myers and gave him those checks as payment on the loan.
Is lack of sophistication between the parties an element in an equitable mortgage case?
I think under Adrian McKinney it is, Your Honor, although there was not evidence in that case that one party was necessarily more sophisticated than the others. But the case does talk a lot about the conduct of the parties and all of the surrounding circumstances. And certainly I would urge on the court that one of the important surrounding circumstances in this case, which underlies how the parties, particularly the Ikes, conducted themselves throughout these transactions, was their relative lack of sophistication compared to that of Mr. Myers.
What do you think why do you think the courts of equity created this animal called equitable mortgage? What was the essential purpose of that remedy?
Some of the early cases that are quoted in Adrian v. McKinney and some of the other cases that I've read talk about the unequal bargaining power of the person borrowing the money who's in desperate straits compared to that of the person who's lending the money who has the cash to lend. And I think that has a lot to do with the genesis of that theory, that the court system has developed this defense to a person in very unequal bargaining power so that he cannot be taken advantage of. And when you look at this case compared to Adrian v. McKinney, we would urge on the court that the facts of our case are, in fact, a much stronger set of facts for finding an equitable mortgage than you had in Adrian v. McKinney. The argument which Mr. Myers made at trial was that it was a lease. And, of course, this is a forcible entry and detainer action, so it presumes a lease. There is no written lease. There is no written lease. In Adrian v. McKinney, there was a lease purchase agreement that was actually in writing, yet an equitable mortgage was still found.
You know, when it comes up here, obviously, standard review is very important. Are you disputing the findings of fact or what, who did what to who when, or just simply what they legally mean, or both?
There are certain findings of fact that in our brief we argue are clearly erroneous, although some of them may be more appropriately entitled conclusions of law. But the standard of review that applies to the recharacterization of documents in equity is one of abuse of discretion. And that's a standard of review that we need to live with and get over. And I recognize the hurdle that entails. But that's exactly what happened in Adrian v. McKinney. And certainly there's the language that abuse of discretion actually means something, that discretion must be exercised based on the facts of the case. And I would suggest to the court that did not happen here. For example, the lease that Mr. Myers purports to have is simply a letter. 4 years, 3.5 years after the initial transaction, he's upset because he's not getting paid on his loans. He sends the Ikes a letter saying, I could probably rent this to you for $3,500 a month. 14 months later, he sends a similar letter, but those are the only documents that they can point to provide any support for their argument that there's a lease, and there is no lease. Nothing now, signed by the Ikes.
I assume both parties testified live in front of the trial court.
Yes, they did.
Does that make your ladder a little taller to climb on appeal because the trial court made assumptions as to the credibility of the witnesses?
Well, there are no findings of fact about the credibility of the witnesses. There's no finding that my clients were not credible or that their understanding of what was happening was not credible.
Well, he didn't buy their story.
I don't know that other than what I see in the findings of fact and conclusions of law in the memorandum opinion. And I think that what it really boils down to is Judge Genap felt that this case, the Ikes case, was not as strong a case as was Adrian v. McKinney for an equitable mortgage. And that's a legal conclusion that's fully reviewable by this court.
Why are you not asking us then to retry this case? Why is this an appeal? Why?
Essentially, we are. We're saying that the judgment in their favor on the forcible entry and detainer action and the writ of possession should both be reversed, and that the case should, in fact, proceed as a mortgage foreclosure. So it would require a remand for a mortgage foreclosure case with all of the rights that the Ikes would have under that process. Or in the alternative, we suggest that at a minimum it should be a contract for deed foreclosure, because it's undisputed that there was a contract for deed in 1999, which Mr. Myers unilaterally decided was going to disappear and become a lease in 2003, and hence his forcible entry and detainer action.
In either case, wouldn't we really be rewarding your clients for either sloppy or non-existing common sense procedures? I mean, should somebody profit from the fact that they do nothing, that all of their financial transactions are handled so poorly, like by sending checks, third-party checks, just forwarding them on without keeping any record whatsoever?
No, Your Honor, if you reverse, you will not be rewarding them for that sloppy business practice. I bring out that practice as an illustration of the lack of sophistication on their part compared to that of Mr. Myers. The reason why you wouldn't be rewarding them for that, if you reverse, is because that issue still needs to be determined. If, in fact, it's remanded for a mortgage foreclosure, a determination has to be made, which was not made at the trial this time around, about how much really is owed. And when the court at that point would make a determination about how much was owed, it certainly would be a disadvantage to the Ikes to not have had the records that I talk about. But that's not the case before us right now, so a reversal, I do not believe, would reward them for that.
So you would, in essence, then be asking for a retrial of the accounting to determine under an equitable conversion or an equitable mortgage how much is owed from the buyer to the seller?
A trial on it, Your Honor, because that issue was not tried below. In fact, the judge made a comment at some point during the trial that he didn't feel like it was necessary for him to make that determination about the amount owed because he was determining that forcible entry and detainer was appropriate and we did not have an equitable mortgage. So there was no finding of fact about how much was owed.
Did you ever try to make a determination about how much Mr. Myers was paid altogether in connection with these two parcels?
Yes, and in fact, it's in the exhibits. He was paid approximately $170,000 in interest and a it's even in his own records, Your Honor. For example, in Exhibit 10, one of his self-proclaimed amortization schedules that he sends out, it shows that at the end of 2004, he had been paid $292,000. I'm sorry. He had been paid $152,000 of principal and $139,000 in interest, and that exhibit is not the final list of all the payments. So that's a total of $292,000, which he had been paid.
Plus, he received a payment from your client's sister
of $202,000.
So he's already received something like $492,000 in.
Yes, Your Honor, for property that was assessed at approximately $200,000.
But on advances of how much? What were the total advances made?
As of the end of Exhibit 6, which takes us up through October of 2004, $263,000 are listed. And Your Honor, the question of advances, I think, is also important because that goes to the conduct of the parties. We have the question of, well, what happened in 2003 when another warranty deed was conveyed? Myers' testimony was, well, there was a cloud in the title because of the contract for deed, so I needed them to deed it to me. But even after that, because of the advances, the parties still conducted themselves as though it was a lender-borrower arrangement, because on Myers' own schedules, every time, starting in 99 and going through 2005, every time he made a property tax payment, a property insurance payment, it on his documents, it's called a loan, and it increases the principal. And so those are included in the advances that are in that total. Not only do we have that, but Exhibit 8 shows that at six times in 2004 and 2005, Mr. Myers listed as loans payments that he had to make to his attorney. We don't exactly know what they were for, but there are six entries of payments to Mr. Hunt's law firm added to the total as loans. Without the existence of a written lease that authorizes one party to collect attorney's fees from the other, So even by Mr. Meyer's own documents, through 2005, the advances reveal that they're still conducting themselves as a lender-borrower subject to an equitable mortgage.
Let me ask you about the warranty deed, or the warranty deeds. Could Judge Guignap maybe have been thinking that this case is different than Adrian, because you've got a document here that's as absolute and unambiguous as any kind of document I can think of in the law. I mean, everyone understands a warranty deed is a warranty deed. And yet, what you're asking us to do here is to say, yeah, it's a warranty deed, but I just didn't intend that. That's not really what I intended. And I mean, that's a slippery slope, isn't it?
But there are cases that we've cited in our brief, and I believe one of them is this Thomas case, where warranty deeds have been recharacterized as equitable mortgages. So there's precedent for that. The facts and circumstances of this case support that conclusion. Plus, I would point to two other very important factors. One is, I don't agree that everyone understands that a warranty deed is a warranty deed. And I think, in this case, the Ikes are two of the people out there who didn't. They testified without real any contradiction or attack that they understood that to be what Myers wanted as additional security for his loan. Secondly, and just as an aside on that, they also signed a contract for deed that in paragraph 11 says buyer stipulates that he is an expert in real estate management and real estate law. I mean, and that's just almost laughable when you look at all the other facts. So they didn't either read or understand what they were signing. But even more significant than that, because I know we can't just throw out every contract because someone says he didn't read it. More important than that is the other documents that surrounded the original warranty deed and the second warranty deed. It's a package of documents. And it's this package that we say constitutes the equitable mortgage along with the conduct of the parties. Myers presented the Ikes on September 1, 1999 with the deed, a contract for deed, and this letter entitled Instructions to Borrowers that specifically says he needs security for his loan. Then in 2003, we have the second transaction. They didn't happen on the same day like the first transaction did, but we have the second transaction where there's the other warranty deed and an amendment to the contract for deed. So given the first transaction followed by the second and the conduct of the parties, including Myers sending out amortization schedules that show along the way that every time he makes an advance, it's listed as a loan, as though it's an advance, like with a collateral real estate mortgage. That whole package, I suggest, certainly would persuade a person such as the Ikes that this was a lender-borrower relationship all the way through.
Back to the letter, though. You only cite the first part of the letter that talks about security. The last part of the letter says that we are purchasing your property and we are selling you the property back on a contract for deed. Now, that's pretty clear, is it not, that there was a sale and a resale back?
And Your Honor, you're correct in terms of my referring to only parts of that letter in the argument here today. We acknowledge the other language in our brief that it does exist, but I would say that the contents of the letter itself are inconsistent. I mean, we have different concepts in the same letter.
Well, if they're inconsistent, that doesn't necessarily show them that the intent was simply a financing arrangement.
But at the top of the letter, in capital letters, and this is prepared by Myers on his real estate firm letterhead, is instructions to borrowers. And then, you know, the rest follows. But it does talk about security. I acknowledge, because I have no choice but to acknowledge, that it does have the language that you point out. But I think when you take that package along with the subsequent conduct, this is still an equitable mortgage case.
One quick question before you run out of time. What about the fact, and I know they didn't pay all the lease payments, quote-unquote lease. I'm not trying to get you to concede it was a lease. But after the $3,500 figure came out on the lease, they did pay at least one, if I recall, maybe more, which would indicate that they're paying something that had never, a payment amount that related to nothing in the past except the lease.
The next month after they got this letter from Myers, they paid $3,500, and then several months later there was another $3,500 payment. So there are two of them, and their testimony was, we got the letter, we thought that's what he wanted to get now, and once again there had been a course of conduct there because the initial transaction required $1,800 a month, and then after we have the amendment to the contract for deed, it went up to $23 something. They had been conditioned during these years to having Mr. Myers say, well, now you need to pay this much. And they would try to do it. They couldn't keep up, probably because of the 14%.
Okay. Justice Sabres is a question. You're not quite done yet.
All right. What is the situation under, if we determined it to be an equitable mortgage, as opposed to, you know, a conditional, a contract for deed, equitable conversion. In a mortgage, you'd what? You'd go back and just determine what was owed, and Myers gets the property, and subject maybe to a refund. Whereas under an equitable conversion. No, wait a minute. Under the foreclosure, under the mortgage foreclosure, they would still have a period to redeem, wouldn't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whereas under an equitable conversion, there would just be a question of the money that would exchange hands, but Myers would retain the property.
Well, no, he would have to, under either alternative, he would have to do a foreclosure action. Either foreclose on the contract for deed, in which case the court would set a redemption period, which can be very limited. Or if it was an equitable mortgage, he would have to do a mortgage foreclosure action in which they would have a much more substantial redemption period under both.
Is that automatic at 180 days, or is that automatic at a year, that redemption period?
I believe in this case it's 180. This is commercial property. But I'm not sure of the answer on that. But there is a substantial redemption period. And under either scenario, the court would have to make a determination about how much was owed. Once again, the Myers would have to live with the fact that they didn't keep good records, so they're not, you know, they haven't gotten away with anything, so to speak, if in fact there's a reversal. But at least they're in the proper form and following the proper procedure.
Thank you.
Well, did the trial court say there was a lease, and therefore they could be just evicted from the property?
Yes.
So that you said that either way there would be a mortgage foreclosure, but if I understand the trial court's ruling, there's nothing to foreclose. There was a lease, and they were to be kicked off the property.
Yes, and that's exactly the judgment we're asking you to reverse.
Right, okay.
And because he determined that there was a lease, we argued there isn't a lease, there's these two letters, nothing signed by the Ikes, statute of frauds applies, and therefore it can't be a lease.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Welcome. Mr. Hunt, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. Certainly this case is about equitable mortgages. And without any doubt whatsoever, and I direct your attention to attachment 2 to our brief, the trial court, without any reservation whatsoever, said the facts of this case do not constitute an equitable mortgage. Reasons given for that in the trial court's letter opinion were as follows. 4 reasons in particular. 1, the defendants executed warranty deeds in January of 2003 in the favor of Myers. 2, the 2003 letter of Myers, which clearly sets forth the lease proposal and the fact that not only once, but at least twice, they paid $3,500 And if the court would make reference to Exhibit 10, the court will note that prior to making that $3,500, they hadn't been making any payments whatsoever, which certainly strengthens the idea that they were responding by their act and conduct to agreeing to the lease as proposed in the Myers letter of March of 2003. The third reason given by the trial court for saying there is no equitable mortgage in this particular case was the fact that in the sale of the home place, the farm place, over on the east side of the interstate in that neck of the woods, basically was done, the sale was for $205,000. Relatives of the Ikes bought the property from Mr. Myers. At that point in time, there was no question whatsoever raised by the Ikes that the Myers did not have title to the property. And if you're trying to protect your relatives, I would certainly think that if you said, hey, you better check this out because he doesn't have title to the property, that would have been done. And the fourth reason given by the trial court for saying there's no equitable mortgage is the fact that in September of 04, the Ikes presented two, not one, but two purchase agreements to Mr. Myers. This was in response to the fact that he had sent them a letter saying, you're not making the lease payments. Now, I would note that counsel for the appellant nowhere in its briefs whatsoever referenced anything about these particular purchase agreements. These purchase agreements were prepared by another attorney for the Ikes, and that attorney basically told the Ikes, this is the way to solve your problem. You have just gotten a notice to quit the property, and so we suggest that if you want the property, you go and buy the property. The Ikes signed, Mr. Ikes signed both of those agreements. Mr. Myers signed those agreements, but they were never fulfilled. There was never full performance because, again, a typical problem. The Ikes did not have any money. So when we talk in terms of an equitable mortgage, it's clear, without any reservation whatsoever, in the mind of the trial court, that for the reasons of the deeds, for the fact that the Ikes never spoke up when the property was being sold, for the purchase agreements, and for the fact that there was a lease, clearly disestablish any argument that there was an equitable mortgage in this particular case.
Now, I questioned Mr. Wilka about the trial court having the opportunity to hear these witnesses live. He said there was no credibility findings made by the trial court as to either side. Do you agree with that?
I agree, Your Honor, the fact that the trial court heard all of the testimony and heard all of the witnesses. I do not agree with the fact that the trial court had to make a specific finding as to the credibility of all the witnesses that appeared in that particular trial.
So you're saying the bottom line is the credibility finding?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
How do you explain away the statement by your own client in October of 99 to the Moody County Office of Equalization that says, this property was in foreclosure and the purchase by Myers was followed by a sale to the Ikes by a contract for deed, not yet filed. The purchase and resale was simply a security vehicle to secure to Myers the money loaned to Ike to redeem the property from foreclosure.
A couple of responses, Justice Sabers. To begin with regards to the testimony of Mr. Miles during the court, he basically gave the explanation of the fact that part of what he was doing there was responding to a particular form, county form, except for information. And he provided that additional information for a couple of reasons, primary of which was the fact that the obviously the auditor's office, the director of equalization, is using information on that form to determine levels of value of property in the area. And Mr. Myers thought that it would be entirely appropriate if the full details of the sale were produced. There was no intent on the part of Mr. Myers, in essence, to classify this as some sort of an equitable mortgage. The term security agreement does appear in that particular statement. I think it's noteworthy to go back into the record of trial on page 21 when Mr. Myers was telling the history of what happened in this particular case. And basically,
shouldn't that be used as an admission against interest on his part?
I think with a qualification of the explanation, I don't certainly put it in the category of a total classification that this document was a security agreement. I think as the court looks at all of the statements that were made, it was certainly clear, as the court addressed their questions to Mr. Wilkup earlier, relative to the letter to the borrowers, it was very clear in that letter at that time that Mr. Myers was buying the property and that it was being sold, in essence, to the Ikes. So there are times when people who are not attorneys, albeit Mr. Myers is presented as a very sophisticated business person, but I would also offer, as in the record, the Ikes are not unsophisticated. They took vehicles apart, they welded them back together, they made modifications in accordance with computer directions from the State Department of Transportation. So if we want to talk about sophistication, I think we need to keep everything in proper balance. But with regards to Mr. Myers, the use of that term was not intended to classify these documents in any way as an equitable mortgage. And the bottom line, Your Honor, should be the fact that the contract for deed was terminated by the signing of two deeds that followed the 1999 deeds. In 2003, 2004, rather, there were deeds signed by the Ikes to Mr. Myers, which terminated the contract for deed. And that's kind of referenced in the opinion of the trial court when he said, when he talks about the fact that, you know, why would Mr. Myers want an equitable mortgage arrangement out of this when he already had a contract for deed, which provided him much more security?
As I understand it, though, that in the beginning, the amount of money that Mr. Myers advanced to the Ikes was the exact amount that they needed in order to pay off the bank. That amount had no correlation to what the actual value of the land was. So how can we say this is a purchase when the purchase price, when there's no discussion about value of the purchase, it's only pertains to the amount of money that the Ikes needed to borrow?
Perhaps I could clarify that, Justice Konenkamp, in the sense that if the initial contract for deed was for $135,000, including a processing fee, like a bank origination fee, if you would, but reference to Exhibit 10, you will notice, actually Exhibits 9 and 10, you will notice that not only did Mr. Myers basically become obligated for the $135,000, but there were two subsequent mortgages as well. Just a few days before September 1999, the Myers executed a mortgage with another bank in the area. And the Myers had to take on that obligation. Then there was the Farm Home Services, or Farm Home Service Credit, whatever it's called today, basically for another $40,000. Those amounts are all reflected in Exhibits 9 and 10. And I would draw your attention to the fact that the $40,000 is dated 4-4-2001. The $64,000 is dated 1-15-2003.
So are you saying that in 1999 he knew that he was going to be taking those further obligations when he made the initial loan?
Well, certainly since the second loan on the property that was in August of 99 was certainly on the books, and Mr. Myers would have been aware of that. Yes, Your Honor. I would also like to point out, while we're on that particular subject, the fact that there's been a lot of discussion relative to the use of terms like loan and interest and payments. Mr. Myers testified during the trial that he uses T-Value, an amortization software. And unfortunately, like a lot of computer softwares, it limits you as far as terminology is concerned. And his primary reason for keeping exhibits like 9 and 10 was to determine where he was in his own investment, in essence. And when you look at the fact that on Exhibit 10, he shows a payment of $202,000, that basically is what he netted from the sale of the home place. Now, I heard briefly comments like $400,000 and $500,000 that he's received. A careful examination of those exhibits will show that that's nowhere close to the amounts that we're talking about in this. When we talk in terms of the rent money alone, he received probably approximately half of what he should have received. And as one goes through Exhibits 9 and 10, you will clearly see that, yes, there were additional payments made by Mr. Myers for insurance and taxes, and he called those loans, but that's because, again, in the T-Value software, he's got to call it something. He can't use those terms. And so it was added on in to show him what his expenses were relative to the money owed him by the Ikes, if you would.
Well, we know he received, you said, $205,000 from family members for the home place.
Yes.
And we know that he received another, as I understand it, $152,000 plus $190,000 in principal and interest. Am I getting those numbers wrong? Or
the $152,000, Your Honor, I'm not sure where that figure is coming from. But let me also say this, that in the bond hearing, supersedious bond hearing in this matter, the son of the Ikes signed an affidavit saying that that particular piece of property was now $256,000, and Mr. Myers sold it for $205,000 just months before. So either things are escalating in values, or we really don't know what the real values perhaps are on some of these parcels. We do know that on the shop property, there were estimated tax values of roughly around $100,000 in that 2003-2004 time frame as such.
In our discussion before, you seem to imply, or at least that's how I understood it, that your opponent would have to approve that, would have to prove that your client intended an equitable mortgage. That's not the test, is it?
The test, I believe, before this court is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion, basically in coming to its conclusion that there was no equitable mortgage.
Right, but in the first instance, isn't the question of whether or not the device was intended for security, not whether or not the grantor or Mr. Myers intended it to be an equitable mortgage? He's never going to intend that, is he?
No, he
has never be to it his advantage.
That your understanding, your statement is correct. I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think it's important, again, to reference the fact, of course, that when the Ikes executed deeds in 2003, returning the property, in essence, clearly to the Myers, it was being done for two very good reasons. One, there was a bank in Brookings that had notified the Ikes they were intending to foreclose. Secondly, no money had been paid to Mr. Myers on his contract for deed, so he was getting ready to foreclose. And again, in the testimony, in the record, Mr. Myers said, you know, he went to the Ikes and said, look, we can get some lawyers and we can start a foreclosure here. And the Ikes said, no, we don't want to get lawyers involved. Why don't we just sign a deed and deed it over? There was a clear understanding that they were signing a warranty deed and not something else with some other implied purpose.
I'm going to make sure I understand these subsequent mortgages. Based on the timing of them, the one to the bank in Brookings, and what was the other one? There were two others. The farm credit, that's not the right word.
Yeah, the farm credit was basically earlier.
Okay.
The one to the bank in Brookings was in August, and it was actually in connection with the same transaction. There was more money owed, basically, by the Ikes than $125 or $135. Meyer stepped into this breach in order to make up the difference, if you would. They'd been able to get some money, but they couldn't get enough. So Myers walked in, and of course, Myers would have been fully aware of all the risks that he was assuming, and as a result, wanted, as he indicates in his letter to the title insurance company, do not basically deliver any money until you can assure me that I will have good title. And that, again, is in the exhibit there.
And so the one mortgage was contemporaneous with the $125,000.
Yes.
$1,000, and the other mortgage pre-existed this whole.
Yes, it was probably a matter of a few weeks.
Okay.
I can get you the exact date, but it was definitely in August, and the other transactions took place in September of 1999.
Because I was wondering how Ikes had title to give a mortgage if they'd already given warranty deeds
to somebody else. And there was an explanation by Mr. Myers on page 21 of the transcript. Basically, he said this. to try to explain it. And what it boiled down to was the bank should have taken a sheriff's deed because they had the period of redemption had expired. The Sioux Falls Bank should have taken a sheriff's deed. But when Bill Myers and some of these others got into the picture, the bank said, as long as we get paid, we don't want to necessarily have to sign any deeds. So as Mr. Myers said, the lawyers basically, but someplace the lawyers agreed that they didn't need to go through the different deeds, and they just got a deed from the Ikes to me. So if it had gone according to the way title companies maybe like to have things go with a very specific chain of title, there would have been, in essence, a sheriff's deed to the bank, and then the bank would have given a deed to Myers. But to short-circuit that, somebody in this process decided, oh, let's just give the Ikes a deed directly to Myers. That again is on page 21 in the transcript. I think that it's also important, in addition to the things that I have mentioned as being key factors in this, namely the fact that the Meyer or the Ikes were facing a foreclosure there in September 1999. The period of redemption had expired, and again, that's established in the record of trial. There was a real need for the Ikes to do something if they wanted to maintain their place of business. And so it's very clear that the deed that they gave to Mr. Myers at that point in time was in essence a financial life preserver for them, and then obviously they signed a deed there in 1999 to Myers. You have a contract for deed which was signed at that same time, and then in 2003, rather than to foreclose on that deed, Mr. Myers and the Ikes agreed to the issuance and acceptance of a warranty deed. Then that, a couple of months later, is followed by the lease in May or March and April of 2003, proposed by Mr. Myers and certainly agreed in action and conduct by the Ikes when they paid $3,500. And the correspondence clearly indicates that this was a lease for less than a year or a year or less, and therefore there's no need to have something in writing as provided by the statute of frauds. The purchase agreements, I think, are just extremely indicative when one looks at all of the circumstances as talked about in Adrian versus McKinney's and talked about in Thomas versus Thomas, the Florida case. The courts say, look at all of the circumstances. Now, why would someone want to buy property if they owned it? And why would they do that when they've had the agreements prepared by an attorney who would have looked at the circumstances, presumably, and given them advice and said, what you need to do is to go and buy the property from Mr. Myers? That act in particular, I think, is very significant and was noted by the trial court in its letter opinion. That plus the fact that why didn't the Ikes speak up when they knew their property, the home place, was going to be purchased by a relative? If they had some question about the title to that property, I would assume that one relative would want to protect another one, especially when the Ikes were living on that particular piece of property. They would want to protect it. But they said nothing at that point in time. And in testimony relative to the lease, the Ikes in open court basically said that, yes, they did pay the $3,500 there within a few days of Mr. Myers' letter proposing a lease. And then when they were asked, well, then did you make other rent payments? They responded, no, we thought those were loan payments. But then a little while later, a few months later, they make another $3,500 payment. None of the acts of the Myers in this whole chain of events really indicates anything other than the fact that they needed Mr. Myers. They were willing to transfer title to his property, which he accepted. They paid him payments. They recognized him as being the owner of the property, and therefore, now to claim an equitable mortgage, Your Honor, I believe is not in any way supported by the evidence and is established by the trial court in its findings, fact, conclusions of law.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt.
Does the record show that Myers was represented by counsel prior to the forcible entry and detainer?
I would have to respond this way. Relative to his dealings with the Ikes, no. In other matters, I have represented the Williams Trust or the Myers Trust for a number of years, and we may have had some conversation, but I'd have to go back and look in detail my records. But basically, Mr. Myers does an awful lot of things on his own because of his experience.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilco, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that Mr. Myers does a lot of these transactions on his own because he's very sophisticated. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he knows how to do it. I disagree with a couple of things that Mr. Hunt stated. First of all, with respect to the Exhibits 12 and 13, the purchase agreements, in desperation, he goes to an attorney that he finds in the Yellow Pages, and there's testimony about this at the trial, and Myers expects to be paid this much money. The attorney says, this is the quickest way to get this done. This is somebody who's just been served with a three-day notice to quit and vacate, and not just get out of a residence, but get out of a shop that's full of tools and equipment and all kinds of things that are shown in the photographs that are exhibits in the record. The person was desperate. Mrs. Ike never signed those purchase agreements, never met with the attorney, had nothing to do with that. That didn't work out, so the Browns step in. Mrs. Brown is Mike Ike's sister. They come up with the $202,000 to pay to Myers. There's certainly no reason for Myers to object at that time. It's because the Browns are helping the Ikes. The Ikes are still living in that house. I mean, their relatives bailed them out. So, of course, he's not going to object to that transaction, whatever the Browns and Mr. Myers want to call it. As far as the questions about how much has Mr. Myers been paid, the records show he's been paid $494,000, principal, interest, in the payment by the Browns, for loans that he made of $264,000 over a seven-year period. And I can guarantee you that if this case is remanded and we go back to a foreclosure case, he will be claiming in that trial that he is still owed additional sums of money in excess of $150,000, over and above the $494,000. He's not saying that he's been made whole by those payments. He's saying he's still owed, if he doesn't own the shop, he is still owed a lot of money, well over $100,000, perhaps approaching $200,000, in addition to the almost $500,000 that he's been paid. This is a person who knows how to take advantage of these situations. He knows how to negotiate the deals, and he did so and does so with people who are very desperate, who are on their last leg, and who obviously have worn out their welcome at the bank. The argument about the software that is used to produce Exhibits 9 and 10 and that only allows one to use the term loan, I think that is deflated by the fact that we also have Exhibit 8, which is a Myers document, which lists all these transactions as loans through 2004, including all the advances. That uses the phrase loan. And just by looking at the document and the print on the document, you know that that's not prepared according to the same software as Exhibits 9 and 10.
Had Mr. Myers never appeared on the scene, was there any evidence in the record that your clients had other options short of falling to a foreclosure by the bank from Brookings?
I don't believe there was.
So but for Mr. Myers, they'd have been off the land today.
I think that's correct.
All right.
I suppose there were ideas out there, but that, you know, I don't think that there was anything concrete enough
All right.
to really point to. I think the bank would have foreclosed and would have taken the property, and they would have been off the land. But in fact, because Mr. Myers loaned them the money, and it was $125,000 plus a $10,000 fee for property that was assessed at approximately $200,000. Whether it would have appraised at that time or higher, we don't know because no appraisal was done. And at that time, I know that Exhibit 10 shows that he later lent them money. Mr. Hunt pointed this out, of $40,000 and $64,000 to take out these other two mortgages. One was done April 4, 2001, the other January 15, 2003, long after the September 1999 transaction, and there is absolutely nothing in the contract for deed or the instructions to borrower's letter or in the warranty deeds which obligated Mr. Myers in the future to take the Ikes out of those loans. Now, I have to concede that the mortgages that underlie those loans were in existence and he would have known about it from a title search, if a title search was done. He was dealing with land title guarantee. He presented no commitment for title insurance as an exhibit, so we don't know if one was really done. He has a letter to Mr. Carlson giving him instructions. It had nothing to do with the Ikes. And once again, unlike most real estate transactions in 1999, there was no real estate purchase agreement done. There were no HUD closing statements done. He talks about a closing at land title guarantee. The Ikes never went to land title guarantee. They signed a bunch of papers at the shop. So this was not your typical real estate purchase transaction. And now Mr. Myers, of course, wants to say that it was absolutely a purchase and nothing more. It wasn't handled like a purchase. It wasn't handled like any licensed real estate agent would handle a purchase of real estate. And it's only an after-the-fact explanation on his part, I would submit, that he's pointing to all of these circumstances as strictly a real estate purchase.
If we go with you to the point of the beginning that it was intended as security, but then we get up to the situation where the warranty deeds are issued, how do you explain away that as something different?
First of all, as a consistent course of conduct that began in 1999, the 2003 transactions, the additional warranty deed, and the amendment to the contract for deed followed and were very similar to exactly the same transaction that we had in 1999. So there's no reason to assume that the Ikes now recognize this as something different. Number two, the Ikes testified that even when they signed that deed, they did so because Mr. Myers told them he needed additional security in his collateral. Third, the conduct of the parties, including Mr. Ike, after the January 2003 warranty deed and the amendment of the contract for deed a little bit later in 2003, still reflects a lender-borrower relationship because these further advances are called loans. They're treated as loans. They're added to the principal. He's charging 14% interest on every advance that he makes, even after the 2003 transaction. And he's still getting some payments. I mean, and one could argue, as Mr. Hunt did, that, well, you know, they must have known in 2003 that this was different. And, you know, why would Myers do that? Well, up to that point, they had really been good about making their payments. I mean, the first couple years, they made their payments with great regularity. It's later in 2002, 2003, especially 2004, that they fell down. So at this point, when Mr. Myers is advancing the additional $40,000 in April of 2001, and we have the amendment to the contract for deed, this has been a good deal for him then. And he's been getting the interest payments at 14%.
What was the interest rate under the bank mortgage?
I don't know. I had no involvement until the eviction started. I probably have a document that would tell me that, but I'm certain it was less than 14%.
Okay, done.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Welcome. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.